read somewhere several years ago that almost 70,000 pedestrians a year are hit by cars. And of those, about over 4,000 die as a result of it. And when police do the investigations into these accidents, the most common excuse given is, I just wasn't paying attention. Either the driver says that, or the pedestrian says that, or they both say that. Somebody wasn't really watching what was going on when that person stepped out into the intersection or whatever it was. I want to suggest that we talk to people a lot about paying attention. As a parent, you try to drill that into your kid's head. Pay attention. And teachers tell that to their students. Pay attention. And bosses say that to their employees. Pay attention. And in the text I want us to look at today, that's exactly the message that the Hebrews writer had for his audience. In fact, he uses that very phrase, pay attention. Pay attention to what you've heard, he says, lest you drift. I want to talk this morning about the danger of drifting. Hebrews chapter 2, let's look at the opening verses. Hebrews chapter 2 and verses 1 through 4, therefore, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. For since the message declared by angels proved to be reliable, and every transgression or disobedience received a just retribution, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? It was declared at first by the Lord, and it was attested to us by those who heard, while God also bore witness by signs and wonders and various miracles and by gifts of the Holy Spirit distributed according to His will. I want us to continue our study of the book of Hebrews, where we're talking about the anchor of hope that we have in Christ Jesus. Hebrews chapter 6, and this is the theme for our year, Hebrews 6 verses 19 and 20 says, this hope we have is an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil where Jesus has entered. Here in the book of Hebrews, as we've talked about before, the writer is addressing Jewish Christians, and I think I just had an aha. Oh, hey, how about that? I deleted my template slide. How about that? The book of Hebrews is written to Jewish Christians who are on the verge of leaving Christ, and it's because as you progress through the book, you start figuring out that many of these Jewish Christians were encountering a fair amount of persecution. Now, as you get toward chapter 10 and chapter 11, the writer makes the point that they had not yet suffered to the point of shedding blood. And it even can be read in such a way that maybe they're not even suffering as much as they had in the past. But whatever the degree of suffering, whatever the nature of it was, they were tempted to abandon Jesus. And so the writer gives this elaborate letter where he says, Jesus is the best thing you have. If you give up Jesus, there's no going back. If you give up Jesus, you're giving up your hope of everything. And the basic gist of the book of Hebrews is that Christ is greater than, and just fill in the blanks. He's greater than anything they had ever experienced. Now, after the introduction in the first four verses of chapter 1, where he says Jesus is God's last word to us, the rest of the book is basically a series of arguments about the superiority of Jesus. The first main argument, which we looked at a few weeks ago, is in chapter 1, where he says that Christ is greater than the angels. And that actually goes all the way through the end of chapter 2, but the formal argument is in chapter 1. In chapters 3 and 4, he argues that Christ is greater than Moses or Joshua. Starting in the middle of chapter 4, and this constitutes a fairly large chunk of the book, Christ is greater than Aaron or Levi. His priesthood is greater than the priesthood that Aaron had. And then in chapters 8, 9, and 10, he talks about the ministry of Jesus. Christ's ministry is greater than anything you read about in the Old Testament. His covenant is greater, the tabernacle is greater, and the sacrifice is greater. So every aspect of what Jesus did is greater than anything you have in the Old Testament. And then starting in chapter 10, verse 19, he starts making some specific applications about their perseverance, about their endurance, about their willingness to endure persecution for the sake of Christ. And then chapter 13 functions as the conclusion. Now, what we're going to look at today is one other point. throughout the book, pretty much corresponding with each major section of the book, there is a formal exhortation. There is an exhortation to do certain things as a result. And again, he ties these exhortations in with the actual arguments of the book. Most of these are embedded more toward the middle of the exhortations, although that's not toward the middle of the arguments, although that's not exclusively true. But the first exhortation is what we're looking at this morning. Pay attention to what you've heard. The second major exhortation is in chapter 3, verses 7 through 19. He highlights the unbelief of Israel and says that they needed to guard against unbelief. The third major exhortation is in chapter 4, where he says, now that the Israelites did not reach the promised land of rest, but we still have that promised land of rest available to us, and he exhorts them to enter that rest. He hits kind of the pause button at the end of chapter 5 and on through part of chapter 6, where he talks about their immaturity. They need to press on to maturity. There's some things he'd like to talk to them about, but they're not capable of handling it. And then at the end of chapter 10, he talks about holding fast to their confession. And then finally, toward the end of the book, at the end of chapter 12, they need to endure this persecution with gratitude and thanksgiving. Each one of these exhortations is well-timed and well-placed and suitable to the argument that each portion of the book makes. Now, we're going to talk about this one this morning, paying attention, as he talked about here in chapter 2. This fits in with the section, the argument number one about Christ is greater than the angels. Now, when we talked about this a few weeks ago, we looked at chapter 1, where the writer gives simply a list of Old Testament proofs that Jesus is greater than the angels. And then right after saying that, he turns to exhortation. He says, now, if that's true, here's what you need to do about it. And then this idea of Jesus and the angels is actually developed again in chapter 2, although it's got a twist to it. Chapter 1 says that Christ is greater than the angels, but then he turns around and says, so why was the Son of God made lower than the angels? It's actually a comment or an explanation of the necessity of Jesus' incarnation. It all ties in with the idea of Christ and his relationship to the angels. But I want you to notice that each one of these sections in this first argument answers a question. In chapter 1, his question is, why is Christ greater than the angels? How do we know that? What proof do we have? The exhortation that we're going to look at this morning, why is that important? Okay, that's a nice bit of interesting information that Jesus is greater than the angels. What difference does that make to me? And then when he talks about Christ being made lower than the angels, he's really answering another question. Why did Jesus become man? Why was he made lower than the angels? If he started out greater than the angels, if he has a name that's greater than the angels, what was the point of making him come to the earth and take on this human form and suffer and die? There's got to be a point to that. So each facet of this first argument is answering, I think, an important question that the writer's audience would make. All right, so here in chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, again, let's go back and read that. Therefore, we must pay closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. Now, notice what he says here. Pay attention to what was heard. That actually goes all the way back to the beginning of chapter 1. Each part of this exhortation is tied in with something that he said earlier. It might be helpful for you to think about the bulk of chapter 1 as simply being a gigantic parenthesis. Because what he does in chapter 1, he says in the opening verses, God long ago at many times and in many ways spoke to our fathers by the prophets, but in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son. God has spoken in his Son. Now, if you kind of block off the rest of that and jump ahead to chapter 2, he says, therefore, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard. Pay attention to what? Pay attention to the message given by God through his Son. In chapter 2, verse 2, since the message declared by angels proved to be reliable, and that is hearkening back to what he said at the end of chapter 1, one of the things that the angels did, they served as messengers, and we'll look at this point a little bit later in the sermon. One of the things that God did was use the messengers to deliver the law of Moses. And so if the law of Moses was delivered by angels, and that proved to be really important. What about the law delivered by the Son? And so that comment in chapter 2, verse 2, takes us back to something said in chapter 1. And then finally, in chapter 2, verse 3, when he says that the danger of neglecting a great salvation, that takes us back to chapter 1, verse 3. The salvation was secured by the Son when he made purification for sins. So pretty much everything in this exhortation has already been introduced back in chapter 1. But now he's tying some of these ideas together in the form of this exhortation. Now, if you look at the exhortation itself, number one, he begins with an admonition. So he says, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift from it. Pay attention is what he says. The word that's used there means exactly what it says. There's nothing fancy about it. You need to concentrate on this message that has been given to you. The warning, though, is that we might drift. And that word that was used there was an interesting word in the Greek language. Sometimes it was meant to be carried downstream past a fixed landing place. If you've ever been in a boat and you got the motor turned off and you're not using the oars and you're just sitting there in the water, you never sit still. You will always drift at some point. And that might be particularly important if you're trying to get back to the dock, if you're trying to get back to the pier, the landing point. If you're not using any kind of motorized devices, it's very easy just to drift past where you intended to go. He says, be careful that you don't drift. The word could also be used in the Greek language to describe a ring that had fallen off somebody's finger. Pay attention that you don't slip. Pay attention that you don't lose something important. This kind of diligence, this kind of vigilance in our thinking and paying attention is absolutely critical when it comes to these important matters. We understand that. There are times when you can kind of tune out of something. There are other times you need to be totally tuned in. There are times when, okay, if I'm watching the ball game, it's probably not the most important thing on the planet. But if I'm talking to my wife, I need to pay attention. If I'm talking to the boss, if I'm talking to my children, if I'm talking to the Lord, I need to pay attention to that. I need to be totally, totally tuned in to what the message says. And so he says we need to pay attention lest we drift. Again, often we are not particularly attentive to things that are going on around us. Now, I think it's interesting. He begins here with a mild warning. Later, as you get into the book, he talks about the possibility of apostasy. And as you get toward the end of the book, he talks about people just totally, outright rejecting the sacrifice of Jesus. Here, he doesn't begin that way. I think that's part of his strategy in the book. He wants to build up the warning. He wants to build up, turn up the heat, as it were. But he starts out with this gentle warning, and he says, look, you really need to pay attention. Why do we need to pay attention to what was heard? Because it came from the Son. Remember that a couple of parables that Jesus gave during his earthly ministry? He gave a parable about a landowner, and it's time for him to collect rent from the tenants, and so he sends some messengers, and they beat them up, and they don't listen. And he sends more messengers, and they get beat up, and they get killed. Finally, he sends his Son, and they think, we're going to kill this man, and we're going to take the inheritance. Are you listening to the Son? The more important the messenger, the more important the message. Some messages deserve to be sent in a way other than a minimum wage personnel. Some messages need to be sent by the most competent, articulate person that you have. And if God has sent his final and greatest message through his final and greatest messenger, how important is that? The message is worthy to be heard. And so he starts out by saying, you need to listen to this thing that's been sent to us by the Son. And then he issues a warning. Okay, what happens if you don't listen? And that's verses 2 and 3. For since the message declared by angels proved to be reliable, and every transgression or disobedience received a just retribution, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? Here's the reason why this is so important. Again, Christ is greater than the angels, and that means that the message delivered by Christ is greater than the message delivered by angels. So yeah, we better pay attention. This business about the law being delivered by angels, there's actually several references to that in the New Testament. In Galatians, for instance. In Galatians chapter 3, down in verse 19, why then the law? It was added because of transgressions until the offspring should come to whom the promise had been made, and it was put in place through angels by an intermediary. Don't ask me what that means. I'm not entirely sure what he means when he says that the angels had something to do with the delivery of the message. I thought it was God and Moses on top of the mountain and God's finger on the tablets. I don't really know all that's involved in that, but there was some kind of messenger, angelic messengers involved in that, according to Galatians 3, verse 19. That's reinforced also in the book of Acts.